established on woody plants. On the other hand, North American insects to Europe, at that time, we could only confirm that there were 34 species that had become established on woody plants in Europe. Just this past month, we published a paper documenting who those American insects are that established themselves in Europe. And we updated the Europe to North America arrivals. Now it's at 310 instead of the old 300. And the North America to Europe, we now have about 57 species instead of 34. And that, it isn't because there are many more new arrivals since 1996, it's just that we've got into unpublished records, you know, in whole at various museums, and so this is this increase is pretty substantial, but it's largely because we didn't get the numbers correct when we published in 96. So this is a pretty solid number than about 57 species. So there's still about fivefold more insects coming from Europe to North America than going the other way. And so this dilemma, this question still is truly unanswered. And what we're doing is we're kind of thinking out loud, providing some kind of hypotheses about why this disparity may exist. And there have been papers published trying to explain these differences in movement between biogeographical realms. And the four major hypotheses are the following. And one of them is that the conduits for dispersal or movement are unequal. So you get more going in one direction or another. The second is that the numbers of species available for dispersal are vastly different between these biogeographical realms. And so as if by Brownian movement, those that are from the abundant area move to the area with fewer, and that explains it. And then, of course, are there differences in the wealth of ecological opportunities for invaders in these different environments? And the final one concerns the differences in the abilities of those organisms as they move from one location to another. Are there basic differences in their survivability, competitive ability, invasibility? And so let me kind of go through some of these now as we try and come down to maybe the most plausible explanations. I think we can probably lay to rest the first two hypotheses, A and B. The conduits are unequal in both directions is one. This is one that's really difficult, of course, to objectively throw away. But we know that when we were colonies of other countries, there were huge volumes of wood products and plants and other goods that went from North America to Europe. In fact, many plants were brought over to Europe to establish botanical gardens for the purpose of, you know, exploiting them commercially eventually. So if you travel through Europe, you'll see botanical gardens in most every country that were established from plants that were introduced in the 18th, 19th, and even the 20th century. And these plants have been widely used in ornamental plantings, in gardens, in parks, and so on. And even today, if you look at the movement of wood products between Europe and North America, there's 100-fold more wood products moving from North America to Europe than vice versa. And of course, during World War II, during all of the World Wars, there was huge cargo volumes going to Europe, and so you would have thought that we should have moved lots of critters in these volumes of material going to Europe. So while we can't truly throw this out because we don't have data on interception records going way back when, but we think that this is unlikely to explain it. The second is, are there more donor species in Europe? And that explains it. Well, it turns out that the insect fauna, there are approximately 100,000 species in Europe and in North America. But there's about 30% more phytophagous insects in North America than in Europe. And we'll take a look at who these are. If you look at the major groups of phytophagous insects, those above this red line, they're about equal. You know, the beetles are about the same. These are the kind of two major dips. They're about the same in number. The hemipalmop groups, they're about the same in number. And then these two groups, the gall wasps and the sawflies, they're about the same too. But below this line, you can see that there are twice as many leps, at least twice as many leps in North America as in Europe. And of course, the Orthopteran is about the same, and you can see the Thysanopteran is about two times also. So here's the argument that there are vastly more insect species available for movement in Europe, North America, but that kind of isn't supported by these data. So we think that the explanations lie in the latter two hypotheses about the ecological opportunities for invaders. And we think the abundance of potential host plants for colonization is crucial. One concerns the richness of genera and species of plants for invaders, and then the absolute abundance or density of these plants in the general landscape. So when the random invader comes, what's the likelihood that it'll find a platform for feeding and reproduction? So we talk about this in terms of the richness or availability of tritrophic niches for these invaders to enter. And then we concern ourselves with the abundance of competitors in those niches, which affects their penetrability, and then also the abundance of natural enemies. You know, how many species of spiders, parasitoids, what about the microorganisms in these tritrophic niches? How might they influence success? And if you look at the total vascular plant flora of Europe and North America, you can see that this is the European number. So that the North America and North Mexico has about 50% more vascular plants. And if you look just at the woody plants, which we're talking about, so we're talking about anything woody, whether it's a vine, whether it's a shrub, whether it's a tree. In the gymnosperms, there are 8 genera of gymnosperms in Europe versus 16 in North America, and 30 species versus 97 species. The angiosperms, it's again about twice as many genera of angiosperms in North America than in Europe, and likewise the species richness is about twice as much. So if you look at all the woody genera in Europe, we see that there's about 86 versus 159, or twice as many potential tritrophic niches for invaders coming to America as opposed to Europe. And so in the 96 paper, we talked about the European crucible, which influenced this disparity. And one part of that crucible was what we call the Pleistocene crucible. When those 12 to 20 glacial epochs entered and ebbed, they caused the extinction of at least 20 shared woody plant genera that were in Europe and shared with America, but went extinct during that Pleistocene period. So they lost about 6 gymnosperms and 14 angiosperms, and that was about 58 species. But these genera, of course, didn't go extinct in America at all. And so some of them are right here. You can see that many of these plants are common and abundant in the, especially, let's say, the eastern U.S. So all of these potential host plants for American insects going to Europe were eliminated during the Pleistocene period. And of course, the explanation that's often proposed is that the mountain chains in Europe flank east to west. And so you have the Pyrenees, the Alps, and the Caucasus. And so as the ice sheets move southward, they forced all of the flora onto the slopes of these mountains and into the edge of the Mediterranean basin here. Whereas these similar glacial episodes in North America, there weren't any mountain chains running east-west. They're all north-south chains. And so we didn't have these extinction events like the European flora experienced. But following the Pleistocene, there was a huge human population explosion in that European area. And we call that the Holocene Crucible during the last 10,000 years, when humans significantly removed or altered the forested flora of Europe. And by 1300, for example, 80% of the forest flora of Central and Southern Europe and Western Europe had been, the forest flora had been removed. Thereby, here we see in 1900, for example, if we look at Atlantic Europe, so all that Atlantic coastal area where ships are coming and going, and the Mediterranean Europe, only 14% of the surface area of the Atlantic coastal Europe was forested. And Baltic Europe, which is, of course, far northern Europe, had more forest cover. But at the same time, in 1910, you can see we had substantial forested cover in the Atlantic U.S. and Atlantic Canada, and the Pacific U.S. Also had substantial cover, and likewise the Great Lakes. But so that human population expansion basically converted those primary woodlands to pasture and arable fields. And it started originally in the eastern Mediterranean basin, and this was the point here was the city of Priene was on the coast of Greece in the year 2600. 600 years later, it was no longer on the coast because they had removed most of the forested cover in the hilly areas of Greece, and they had just massive soil erosion. And of course, you can see what happened. It flushed down and changed the entire coastal line. And of course, this happened from the east to the west. And this was a painting done by Peter Bruegel, a Flemish painter, done in 1565, and it's called Hunters in the Snow. And it was done in, depicting an Italian landscape. And you can get an idea of what this landscape looked like in the 1500s after all of this human development. So we think about this in terms of tritrophic niches. How many are available as an invader arrives? And so we think about the total number of native plant genera plus the number of introduced genera. And this then sets the potential for a species to expand or invade and expand into a country. But then we also need to consider their availability. You know, how abundant are they? How apparent are they? And it's a function of their relative abundance in those landscapes. And both of these things, the richness of tritrophic niches, the availability of tritrophic niches, were diminished, of course, during that Pleistocene and Holocene crucible. But after having been found, once a plant platform is found, of course, then penetrability is a function of plant quality, the nutritional quality of the tissue, the defensive quality of the tissue, and also, of course, what you might consider then the biotic resistance, those competitors and natural enemies associated with those tritrophic, those plants. And, of course, all these species, they will have a counteracting quality and biotic resistance. So you might have a plant that actually is in low in quality for it, because it has low biotic resistance, that plant is indeed a potential platform for an invader. But the ideal hosts, as we'll talk about in a bit, would actually be high in quality but low in biotic resistance. In fact, these are the introduced American plants to Europe. And if we look at what those invasive Americans have done, they colonized 35 genera of plants. 11 of that 35 were strictly North American plants, such as the genus Caria. The other 24 genera were the European genera matching the North American hosts of those American plants. So those are the genera, and if you look at the insects themselves, 16 invaders, or 28%, occur only on North American plants in Europe. In other words, they accompanied that plant, or the plant preceded them, and so they exist only on North American plants. So if those North American plants were there, obviously these 16 species. 2 minutes?
2 minutes.
Wow, I'm eating up more time than I thought. So let's roll here. I just wanted to mention this. North American insects on North American plants, they have higher populations in Europe than they do in America. And European insects that are lucky enough to colonize those North American plants, they also have higher populations on American plants than they do on their native host. And only one insect out of 57 has been an economic problem in Europe. And if those of you who are wine lovers know, it's the grape phylloxera. That's the only insect that's been an economic problem in Europe. On the other hand, if you look at how many of those European species became a problem in America, I'd say about 10 to 20% of those Europeans invading America have become problems on American plants. And it's also interesting to know that insect species loading on plants is higher there than it is here. So if you look at, say, equivalent groups, there will be more species on a plant in Europe than on the equivalent American plant. Let's pass on, Paul. So if you look at, for example, the beetles constitute about 60% of the fauna in America and Europe. What percentage of those coleopterans actually become invasive, whether they go to, it's only about, let's say, 15%. If you look at the Homopterans and Hymettes, you'll see that most of, only 25% and 40% of them are representative invasives. And they happen to be, they're mainly parthenogens. So those groups, those highly represented groups, are often parthenogens, and so they happen to have very low LE thresholds. So you don't need very many of them to actually take off and establish themselves. Thank you very much.
Before I get off on this, the actual Asian part of this, I'm going to bore you a little bit with the history of the gypsy moth in North America and what's going on with the European gypsy moth or the North American gypsy moth programs as a background for this. As most of you know, one of the best documented introductions of an invasive pest, accidental at least, that's ever been made occurred in the late 1860s by caused by a personal hero of mine, Etienne Leopold Trouvelot. I did my doctoral work on this and my master's on the gypsy moth and actually dedicated my dissertation to this guy because it wouldn't have been possible without him. As you're aware, it's a Polyphagus forest defoliator, and the strain that Trouvelot brought over was from Europe where, at least at the time, the females were all flightless, so we have flightless females here in North America. It still periodically defoliates large areas of deciduous forest. We were up into the millions of acres again in the Northeast this year. Nothing like the 14 or 15 million that we hit in the early 80s, but hopefully it won't get back up to that level. And it has spread throughout the Northeast since its introduction, mostly of its own accord, but we've helped. This shows the area in red here that's currently under quarantine is considered the generally infested area in the United States. I do want to point out that the Forest Service has a very extensive program that's based on pheromone trapping. Patrick mentioned it, I believe, a little bit in his talk, that runs all the way from up into Minnesota down into the Carolinas, where they, based on specific algorithms of trap catch, they go in and then treat to try and slow the spread down, based on the theory of squelching these little outlier populations. And this. Over the past decade or so, they've treated literally millions of acres, mostly with mating disruption formulations at this point, racemic dispar lure, so that even though it's a very extensive program with a lot of control effort, it has a very small environmental footprint. Well, anyway, what are the regulatory efforts to try and keep gypsy moth where they are? Well, we do recognize that human-mediated movement is the way that it can take the big jumps. Household moves are a big way that it moves, and there are other ways also, and we do find, despite USDA quarantines to help reduce this human-mediated spread, we do find every year populations out in the western part of the United States. As such, there are about 350 pheromone traps placed outside the generally infested area every year. A lot of these are in the Slow the Spread program, but a lot of them are not also, especially out in Oregon and California and Washington. When populations are detected, they are eradicated, and to eradicate them, and basically the key information that we use for this whole program is based on the trap catch to determine the extent, geographic of the population, the size of the population, and so on, and make our management decisions from there. And I already mentioned the Slow the Spread program. How do they decide where to put the traps? Well, it's derived from expert knowledge. It's risk-based with knowledge of gypsy moth behavior biology, host availability, and of course human activity, since we're the ones that are moving at the long distances. Still, what we are doing right now in terms of trap placement and where we allocate our trapping resources is, reflects information technology that was really coming out of the 1970s. We are the states do have some variations. There have been some advances, but it's been slow. And what we have been trying to do more recently is, and Al Sawyer and Vic and some other folks are working with the people at Clark University to develop some neural networking type models to determine risk in various parts of the United States. We incorporate on a little more quantitative basis a lot of the information that I talked about before, and for the first time actually we have actually been able to access the U.S. Post Office database of household moves and incorporated that into this model. So anyway, with all this in place for gypsy moth, why are we worried about Asian gypsy moths? I mean, it's the same species, right? It's Lamantria dispar. Well, for one thing, it's most likely to come in the West Coast, which is currently uninfested. That's a real minor point, though. The major points are more that the female Asian gypsy moths are very capable flyers, unlike their European counterparts. This, of course, can increase spread rate from infested areas into uninfested areas, and it also, as I was talking about, since our most of our management is based on knowing where they are on the basis of trap catch, this negates a lot of the management paradigms we have. The other factor is that the Asian gypsy moths are supposedly even more prolific and more voracious than European gypsy moths, which could, you know, potentially increase the frequency and extent of defoliation. And hostless, if you've worked with them, tend to be a little sketchy, and you never know quite what it means when you see a report of a plant as a host on a host list. But at least potentially, it may also be that we could be putting additional host species at risk and also creating a higher probability of establishment in areas with hosts that might not be suitable for European gypsy moths. Along with the Asian gypsy moth, we've got a couple of other species of concern. One is Lamantria mathura, the rosy gypsy moth. This is occurs in Japan and Eastern Asia, down into India. It's another defoliator that has a real fondness for Fagaceae, especially beech in this case, another insect we don't need. The nun moth, you may be familiar with, occurs from Europe in through Eastern Asia and into Japan, and this is sort of the coniferous version of the gypsy moth. And there are a lot of other species in Eastern Asia, which is thought to be the cradle, evolutionary cradle of Lyonotriades. And then there are these new species that we have to worry about. Taxonomists are always doing strange things to us. Pogue and Schaefer just published the book recently, this year, as a matter of fact, and they had split a couple of or a few new species out from dispar. This can create problems, at least in the short term. Hopefully, in the long term, it will solve things. But we had a group from China up to our lab about it was within the last month, actually, and after a couple of days of nice show and tell and nice meals and so on, we tried to get down and sit and talk about some of the nuts and bolts of some of the port monitoring programs, and we said, well, we want to go through this park and we want to trap this species and this species. They said, wait a minute. I said, no, you talked about dispar. Now, you can't add these other species in on us. We said, well, when we started these negotiations, these were dispar. So they create problems. Asian gypsy moths have been detected quite a few times in the United States. Some of the early detections were large populations that were very expensive to get rid of. The one in North Carolina, perhaps surprisingly, came in on a ship from Germany, where it came into dock, was bringing military materials back, and these moths started flying off the ship out onto the surrounding area. And we went back to the Germans and go, no, we don't have Asian gypsy moths. Yeah, right. somehow they managed to get it into it. But we've had quite a few detections over the past number of years, and we seem to be getting to the point where at least the areas of the programs are much smaller. Sometimes only trapping occurs. So I think we're doing a better